I like to, yeah, remind teachers that we never know sort of what type of seeds we're planting in our connections with other kids, and that sometimes what you think could be like a meaningful conversation is actually like a life-saving conversation.
De leiders en professionals van Nederland helpen nog beter te worden in hun werk. Dames en heren, dit is Denk Tank, de podcast van Denk Producties. Mijn naam is Remy Gieling. Naast mij is neergestreken, zoals altijd, oprichter van Denk Producties en co-host Hans Jansen. En met ons in, nou ja, niet de studio, maar in een hotelkamer, is hier Maggie McDonnell, verkozen tot beste docent ter wereld. En we gaan horen waarom dat is. Maggie, so happy to have you with us here today.
It is a pleasure to be here with you guys. I would come and share stories with you anywhere, even a hotel room next to Utrecht Central Station. Yes.
Thank you so much for organizing this for us, Hans.
Yes, we have a pop-up studio that can go anywhere.
Living the high life. Yes. Yeah. So, first of all, Hans, why are we here today? You have Maggie in several of your shows. And yesterday you saw her again at a production you did for Diade.
Yes. Well, you will notice Maggie is a remarkable person with a remarkable story. And the fact that she just admitted that this will be her first podcast ever. So we do have kind of a world premiere here. But she was nominated Best Teacher of the World. And we will hear later why that was the case. And she was a speaker at our conference with Barack Obama. And what I always try to do is when we have a conference, you have people like the Trojan horse, so the people that are on the poster and people buy a ticket for. But we also try to get people on stage that people may not know from the name, but they do surprise because of their remarkable stories. And I'm really sure Maggie was one of them. People emailed us. They said, I bought a ticket for Barack Obama, but I was really impressed with Maggie. So that was amazing.
So Maggie, first podcast. We have a high bar to set.
Yes.
I'm sure.
Are you excited?
Yes, I'm totally excited to be here. I love being around you guys.
Yeah. So as the listeners might have noticed, we're talking in English. That's because you're Canadian. Where exactly are you from?
I grew up in Nova Scotia. It's like a province along the Atlantic coast of Canada, but I'm probably most known for working in the Arctic. Canada is huge compared to the Netherlands. So there's a lot of time zones, and basically from Nova Scotia to the Arctic itself is easily like a 2 to 5 day journey, I guess, depending upon what part of the Arctic you're going to finally land in.
And it's somewhere at the West Coast all the way up north, if I'm correct.
Like, yeah, the Arctic, we can say, spans across like the whole country, like east to west. I would be in I typically work in a region called Nunavik, which is Inuktitut for meaning our land. And it's located in northern Quebec, if you've heard about the province of Quebec or Montreal or Quebec City. But it's quite a bit northern from there. You would take a flight from, we call them gateway cities. So Montreal is a gateway city to the north, or Toronto is a gateway city to the north. So you would fly from, you know, maybe Halifax to Montreal, and then you connect to carriers that just service the north. And so from there, the flights are pretty expensive. They can cost from, you know, honestly, 2,000, probably up to 15,000, depending how far you're going or where your final destination is.
Wow.
And then you often, we call it the milk run. So you often board tiny planes. They're not huge by any means. And you stop at each village along the way. So before you get to your final destination, like my village might be the 8th village en route. So there's a lot of up and down on the runways. There's a lot of stop and goes. And then every time you land, you run into issues of maybe weather. Can the next takeoff happen? Honestly, there's stories of like polar bears being on the runways, things like that. So your plane's delayed, a hunter needs to come and like remove the animal or et cetera, scare it away, et cetera. So it's always an adventure for sure.
So how long was your trip over here?
It would take about typically, you'd want to give yourself at least 2 days to get from Nunavik to Montreal if you're doing an international trip, because the air carriers don't connect. So the airline I work with in the north called Air Inuit, it doesn't have like an agreement with KLM. So if there's delayed flights with Air Inuit, it's not like KLM is going to be aware of this and adjusting my flight. So you need at least 2 days to sort of get yourself out of the Arctic back into what we would call Southern Canada. And then from there, it seems quite easy after that, just hopping aboard a KLM flight or something, you know, from Toronto or Montreal to Amsterdam. Yeah. Mm. Which is maybe 8 hours or it's only across the ocean. It seems easier than getting out of the Arctic sometimes.
And you even flew in with a kid. How do you keep it? Keep him or her entertained.
I have a pandemic baby. I'm guilty of that. And he is 1 year old. So it was my first time to travel with him. It keeps you up. You definitely don't sleep, but to be honest, a lot of the other passengers, I think, just love seeing kids. Maybe with the pandemic, with COVID, we're so just starving for social interaction and all that. So you always get great reactions from like the other passengers. But as a mom, you're kind of constantly worried that they're going to be crying all through the night and keeping everybody else up on the plane. But we got through it. So that's what matters.
And how remote is, because you said Inuit Airlines. So how remote is the place you're living?
My community, it would be considered quite remote. It is only reached by airline, so there's no roads that connect the communities. There are, in the region I work, 14 Inuit or Cree communities located all along the coast. And so they're all, each one is about a 2 hour flight from the next one, roughly. Some are maybe 45 minutes, but about a 2 hour flight. So there are other Inuit villages located even further north than where I've lived and worked that are even more remote. But yes, I would definitely consider it remote.
How many people are living in this community?
In the community I work in, there's about 1,600, maybe 1,800 now. The population is growing pretty rapidly. There are some communities with just 300, and the larger communities might have around 2,500 people.
And is it also, I mean, if we think of polar societies, do people still use like igloos, and is it really, really cold?
It is absolutely freezing. It's but the cold is like, the cold got reframed to me for sure, for just seeing what the benefit it was. Mm-hmm. So the temperatures easily go down to, I mean, always minus 25, usually minus 30. It can go down to minus 40, minus 50, or minus 60. And they can have amazing storms where winds are, you know, 150.
Which is Celsius, right?
Yes. You guys are also using Celsius. Definitely. The winds can gust to like 150 kilometers an hour. So sometimes you can have these huge snowstorms. You literally can't see like the hand in front of your face. A trick we often do for fun is we grab a pot of tea on a really cold day and we'll throw it outside and it will like freeze before it hits the ground. So it is very cold, but the coldness is its strength. It's what allows everything to freeze. And so there's so many bodies of water in the Arctic, but as the cold comes and they freeze over, all that land gets connected, and that's what allows the Inuit just to like move and travel so freely beyond the land to hunt, to track caribou, et cetera. So climate change is something we're really, I'm going to say the climate crisis, because I think climate change is just not drawing enough attention to what's really happening. But the climate crisis is something we really see in the North. So often it's talked about being a green movement, but in the North, it's about making sure the North is still white and cold, you know, and full of snow and ice, like 8-10 months of the year. And now we're noticing that the Arctic is actually greening. And even me as a foreigner who's only been there 10 years, I can see that difference. And that's pretty shocking. They say the Arctic is experiencing the climate crisis at 4 times the rate of the rest of the world. So it's really like a barometer of what's coming.
How, you talked about your job. What do you do for a living?
I am a teacher. I just love working with young people. I love the possibility of education. I think it's like a really exciting profession in that like yeah, the future's kind of, you're part of the future. You're making the future with students every day. So I've always loved working with young people. And then when a teaching opportunity came up in this Arctic village, I wanted to jump on it because also as a Canadian, I wanted to understand more about my country and like, especially there's really tragic historical relationships between settlers in Canada and Indigenous folks. Mm. And I saw it as an incredible opportunity for me to go and like live in an Inuit village and really learn firsthand from their experiences.
Yeah. And you're not, I mean, we don't do a podcast with your average teacher of a remote city in very northern Canada, but you've been awarded the prize, the best teacher of the world. So of all teachers there are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was unexpected, yeah, but unreal. It was in 2017, my students had nominated me for what's called the Global mm-hmm. Teacher Prize. It's founded by Sonny Varkey and the Varkey Foundation. He is an amazing education philanthropist. And basically, he said he wanted to create the Nobel Prize for Education. Mm. And so they've put $1 million behind this prize. Mm. And the year I was nominated, there were 20,000 teachers from 179 countries who were nominated. So they have an amazing network, which grabs some incredible stories, you know, about how education is transformational. So I got named to the top 50. I thought that's a career highlight. I'll never surpass this. I got named to the top 10. That actually really freaked the heck out of me because, you know, all of a sudden there's quite a bit of attention. You're maybe dealing with like imposter syndrome or et cetera. I'm also in such a remote place of the world. I'm having trouble maybe identifying with the context of this award and what it could mean. And then they ended up flying me and all the other top 50 teachers from around the world to Dubai. We were hosted by Sheikh Mohammed in Dubai for an amazing out of this world education conference. And on the last night of the conference, literally from the space station, they had an astronaut pull out an envelope, just like they do on the Grammys, you know, when they pull out an envelope. So he's in space and the envelope's floating in space and he grabs it and he pulls it out and he says my name as the winner. And And here I am on your podcast.
Yes, yes.
Things have changed dramatically since he made that moment.
Yeah. In a small cramped hotel room in Utrecht. The only way is up.
Yes. From Dubai to Utrecht. Yeah. That's only a very small step. Yeah. So, and of course, it's not a lottery. I mean, you've been chosen based on your achievement. So can you share a bit of the situation in the little village that you found when you got there?
Yeah. I mean, I've talked about the climate, it's freezing, you know, I've talked about the geography, it's panoramic, you know, stunning landscapes of like frozen tundra. But probably even more gripping than that is the social issues happening in the community. I mean, by all means, I want to honor the culture and the resilient folks that have lived there for 15,000 years. But the Inuit in the last 100 or years or so have gone through like some really dramatic trauma due to colonization. They've been subject to residential schools, which in Canada we now consider a site of genocide. This was a policy by the Canadian government to basically attempt to assimilate all Indigenous youth, but it was done with incredible amounts of abuse and neglect. So Indigenous children were removed from their families at the age of 5 or 6. So if any parents listening to this, I mean, right away, they've just got to understand like who goes in and takes like a 5 or 6 year old away from the loving arms of their parents. The Canadian government did. And they brought them to boarding schools, which were very far away, often like a plane ride away, for example. And there they endured so much abuse, neglect. It's disgusting. It's things like nutritional experiments were run on them. They were shamed for speaking their language. They were forced to cut their hair. Growing your hair long is often like a sign of strength and spirituality in a lot of indigenous cultures. They weren't allowed to talk to their brothers and sisters in their language, anything like that. So a lot of them, and they just suffered all sorts of physical abuse, emotional abuse, and sexual abuse as well. The schools were often run in partnership by the church. And at this point, still, so many Indigenous folks are seeking an official apology from the Pope themselves. These are big issues. These are big headlines in Canada. And in the last year during COVID, some Indigenous communities, in an attempt to truly show what has happened, have invested money into going back into these residential schools, which are now closed, and they're investigating the grounds around these schools, and they're consistently finding graveyards and unmarked graves of small children. So this was truly like both a cultural genocide and a genocide, of what happened here. And so Indigenous folks in Canada have been carrying this trauma for so long. And in addition, I mean, in my community, we don't even have running water. Okay. We have a housing crisis as well. So there's all sorts of sort of underfunding issues that are also going on there. And so it's resulted in like a suicide crisis for young people. They're just dealing with so much collective trauma, so much collective pain. There are very few outlets that the government basically neglects to invest in the health infrastructure, the educational infrastructure, all of that type of thing. And so it was heartbreaking to say this, but it almost became normal to expect that about 10 young people in my community may commit suicide per year. You know, so that would mean as a teacher, you know, the school's going to be shut down once a month for a funeral. That you're going to come back as a teacher to a classroom with an empty desk. That's not going to be filled anymore by that student. That affects me as a student, as a teacher, but all that was doing to my students as well too, because they were consistently witnessing the loss of like friends and family, you know? And then there's so much research out there to show that even if you've lost one person to suicide, even if you've just been exposed to that through some part of your life, you are now more at risk of suicide yourself. Even it might just be slightly, but you are more at risk. For most of my students, they've lost like more than 20 people to suicide. So, and close people, like their best friend, their cousin, it could be their mom, you know? So I can remember this one time. It was my student, her name was, I'll call her Paula for the sake of this interview. So Paula was just turning 16, and I knew it because a teacher, we always have their birthdays listed somewhere on some attendance sheet or et cetera. So I was like, let me go home. I'll make her a cake. I'm a terrible cake baker, but I'm like, I'll try my best. So I even bought like a cake making kit, you know, or from a box. I did it, put some frosting on it, decorated it, brought it to school, and she was so happy. You know, we enjoyed it right before the bell, before recess, and we celebrated her and honored her 16th birthday. And as she was, as the class was leaving the door, she stopped and she paused and she said, "Maggie," after everybody had left and we were in a private moment, she said, "I want to thank you so much for that." She's like, "I never thought I'd get to the age of 16. And I was like, "Well, can you unpack that? What do you mean?" She's like, "There's just been so much loss and suicide around me that," she's like, "this is big, you know, that I got to 16. And she was so joyful and happy, you know, that she had made it to 16. But as a kid who's lost, for her, at least 15 people, you know, getting to 16, getting through those like turbulent, troubled adolescent, preteen, post-teen years is like so crucial, you know? So it was really like, I was constantly being hit with sort of the depth of what they were going through small interactions like that, where I would just go in unassuming, "Oh, I'm making a birthday cake, blah, blah, blah." But you know, would turn into this profound conversation about how she was so proud of herself for fighting everything, you know, to get to the age of 16, and that she was excited about her future life.
Mm.
I want to talk in a bit about how you motivate these kids to get the best out of themselves, even in these very harsh circumstances. But first, can you paint a picture? What does a classroom look like? How many students are in it? What does it physically look like? How often are you teaching there?
Perfect. Yeah. I mean, it looks like probably a classroom or a school building that you might find here in the Netherlands, that type of thing. You know, we'd have, but our schools are probably a bit smaller because of our population size. So I taught in a school for what you call like grade 5 to secondary 5. So sort of like the end of primary, junior school, and high school, if that might translate to the system here. And we would have maybe 230 to 250 students. So sort of ages, let me say age 10 to age 18, right? And there would be another school of pure primary kids, you know, age 5 to age 10 per se. And my class, I was actually brought up there to teach a program that was just kind of to be catered towards the kids who had dropped out or who were at risk of dropping out, because we have a big school dropout problem. So I had on my list about 15 kids, but that could fluctuate throughout the year. It might grow to 25, it might shrink down to 12, you know, so usually around 15 or so were the kids on my list per se. But in a small community like that, or in a small school, you end up sort of having an influence on like the whole school body. And so, you know, we have to be very flexible. There's often teaching shortages, so it's difficult to recruit teachers to come to those communities long-term. So I might be there as life skills teacher for that alternative group, but I'm going to be helping out with social studies or English or physical education or et cetera, depending if there's like a full-time teacher there or not.
Yeah. And of course, if you look at the situation they're in, you already mentioned there was a lot of a big suicide crisis, but I guess there's also a lot of alcohol. There must be some all kinds of way people flee from the situation, right?
Absolutely. Like you're in, there's been such a lack of investment by the government. They've been through so much harm and trauma that a lot of people are coping like in really negative ways, like really, really dangerous ways, I should say. I almost don't want to judge how people cope, because I get that they're coming from a certain experience and this is, you know, a choice that they're making. But for sure, so many young people, so many adults are coping with, you know, alcohol, marijuana, drugs, etc., and even like self-harm became a way of coping. I can remember once coming into my class and witnessing one of my students bring out a razor, and she started cutting her arm on the desk where
in
I
public,
was.
Actually,
and I still am constantly learning about these practices, but for some folks, cutting becomes a way to take this emotional pain and sort of put it into a physical place, you know? And so even though it looks quite horrific, it is giving her some amount of relief, but it's very alarming, obviously. Mm. So when I see that happening, I'm like, okay, I have to get her to like the counselor, the social worker. I need to find some way to keep working on building a real relationship connection with her, trying to unpack like what's the root cause. And of course, like she was having troubles at home. There was some dysfunction there. She didn't feel safe, et cetera. And all of this was manifesting, you know, and it turned out into actions like that. But as much as possible, what I tried to do with kids was to just build genuine connections with them. And tap into their interests, you know, and tap into things that they love to do, or and help them dream in a sense. I would always say they have huge problems, so we need to have huge dreams to sort of combat that. Mm. And as much as possible, as somebody who has a background in like physical education, et cetera, I really wanted them to pick up other ways of coping, you know, and that might be talking to friends, like having a great support circle. It might be running, fitness, starting a hobby, crochet, knitting, like playing basketball, soccer, et cetera. We ended up creating a fitness center, something like a Train More, I think if I'm in the Netherlands, that's what you guys would call them here. We created one of those in the community. So we actually like invested into the health and wellness infrastructure of the community. And it was a super hit. You know, it took off so well, and it helped, you know, provide a space for kids in the community to come together and both, you know, engage in a healthier coping strategy, but also feel the collective support of other kids or adults doing the same thing.
Yes, because you already mentioned the fitness center, which I thought was a real brilliant way to get people spend time on more healthy stuff and also being able to cope with things, I guess. You started your talk yesterday with a great example of the bikes. Can you share that with our listeners?
Sure. When I got to the community, like I said, I was supposed to teach these kids who were all dropouts, and they were true dropouts. None of them came to class. Like I was sitting in that class for a week and it was empty. And so I'm asking my principal what to do. And he's like, well, they have pretty poor attendance, so try your best, you know? So basically I was like, I'm going to take that as permission to like go out in the community. I have their names. I'm going to try to find out where they live.
Try to find your students.
Yeah.
In the city,
where the
in
heck town. Are
yeah,
they?
Yeah.
And I found out they were basically like a bike gang in town, and a ton of them were like stealing bikes all day and joyriding them, vandalizing them, all of that type of stuff. And they had most of them had a terrible reputation in the community. They were known as vandals, pickpockets, you know, thieves, etc. But I was like, wow, they love bikes. Let me try to work with that. So I ended up talking to the mayor, the principal, et cetera. And I said, can we do something with bike mechanics? And they said, sure, go give it a try. And the coolest part is I know nothing about bike mechanics. I wish I had friends back then from the Netherlands, because you guys are obviously gurus at everything bicycle here. But I didn't know you folks then. So I went through some other connections to try to find a bike mechanic, and I found the perfect candidate. Because again, imagine I'm working with some really hard, disgruntled, angry kids, okay? Who like walk around all day in hoodies and sunglasses. And if I could see their eyes, they're giving me the death stare, okay? And so I found this amazing bike mechanic. He owned a bike shop in Montreal. He was originally from, I believe, Chile, and he identified as an anarchist. And I was like, yes.
I need you.
Yeah, I need you. I don't just need any bike mechanic. I need an anarchist bike mechanic. And so I sent him like a fur parka. I said, put that on and get on the plane and come on up here and help me out. And he came up for about 3 weeks, brought up some great tools, like taught us how to set up a bike shop, how to repair bikes, all that type of stuff. And it was phenomenal. You know, the kids were just coming, they were enjoying it. They were building their own bikes. One cool thing about the North is that it's so isolated that your garbage never leaves. So there's just this one huge dump outside of the community, but they really take care of it well. So there's different sections inside the dump, and it's almost like, they would call it like an IKEA, you know? So you go to the dump, there's like the kitchen section, you know, there's the furniture section. There was also the old bike section. So we would go to that section, grab all these old bike parts, et cetera. They started building their own bikes, which they loved because they felt so cool about that. And they were joyriding them and enjoying them. And then they stopped stealing bikes from like the little 8-year-olds in the town that they were previously terrorizing. And then the community, of course, because it's a small place, they hear about it, or they notice that their kids' bike's not stolen anymore. And then they started coming and bringing their bikes for my students to fix. And like, to me, that's when it became like, I'm an empath. So anytime like you build that community into stuff, that's when it's like truly golden to me. So when my angry, you know, disgruntled, hardened teenagers were now softened so much that they were like, you know, giving paint jobs to like their 8-year-old cousin's bike, you know, and fixing their bike. Well, what I will always say is that they weren't just fixing that bike. They were fixing their relationship with the community. And also credit to that community, because one thing I've learned about Inuit culture is they always give people so many chances, right? Mm. So the adults, even though they were frustrated with my teenagers, by all means, they always, you know, they were waiting for them to like mature, have that spark, have that turn, have that pivot, you know, and take on a new leaf. And they would welcome that, you know, so easily and support that when they could. So yeah, that's my bike story.
Yeah. So that was kind of the tipping point where you started to see and started, you connected and you saw that when you do care and you do put out initiatives that you can turn things around. And then you made a fitness center, and you even also have a brilliant story about where you said you replaced big problems with big ambitions and big dreams. There was a real big dream for some student was actually running, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my students, well, that was something we got into, was running. I mean, and we would run a long time. Mm. Like it started out just running 5Ks or 7Ks, 7 kilometers. And then two of them said to me that they wanted to run a half marathon. And my inner voice said, heck no. That's impossible. It is so cold out here. Like to run a half marathon, to train, you need to be outside, like sweating for like 2.5 hours, like 3 times a week. And it is minus 40. Like that's what I said in my inner voice. And I just put a frozen smile on my face and I'm like, okay, we can do this. I believe in you. And, it was incredible. We trained for 4 months and we fundraised. And I took, the first time I took one female runner, she was 14. I took her all the way to Hawaii. She ran up a volcano, down a volcano, and she crossed the finish line in second place. Oh, and wow. It was unreal. And then the story got back to the community. The next year we went with, you know, probably a dozen runners. They all crossed the finish line. And then we expanded to other villages and also with the running group, because you know I'm an empath, so there has to be another goal in it as well. They've fundraised almost $500,000 at this point for like other Inuit youth. So every time they run on a race, a portion of the money goes towards a nonprofit that does great work in the north with other Inuit youth. So yeah, that's the running story. So,
very cool.
Yeah, I think now people start to realize why you became the best teacher in the world, right?
Yeah. It starts to sink in.
Yes. Yeah. Can you perhaps just as an example, show us, because you've been doing so many things that are really connecting people and taking them away from the dark side and bringing them to a better side of their lives. Can you share one case of a person, you know, he or she, what did this do to their lives?
I can remember it was New Year's Day. I believe it was 2017. At that point, it was my holiday vacation and I had run off with my fiance at that time to Tanzania and we had just gotten married. And I thought, wow, this is like the biggest thing I'll ever do in my life. One of the best days of my life. And then it's January 2nd. I log into my Facebook and I scroll down and I see that one of my students who's in sort of a reflective state because of the new year transition has made this whole post. And in it, she thanks me for saving her life. Mm. And I had really no clue. I had played that level of influence in her life. But in the post, she said that there was a moment where she had a very concrete suicide plan and an intention to do that. She had planned it out. She was actually, some youth, they're just dealing with so much pain from all that intergenerational trauma that they see suicide as a way to like escape the pain, right? So often it's not that they want to die. They just want to like, how to get rid of this pain, how to get a relief from that. And so she had a plan. And then I can remember her coming to talk to me. And I know that it was emotional and I had helped her and we talked about things. And I think we had gone up to the fitness center for a workout and I connected her with some other youth. And, you know, I had been in touch with her parents and family that day too. But even me in that moment, I didn't know that it was that deep, you know, that that's where she was planning, what she was actually planning on doing, you know, that weekend per se. So there's been some really profound experiences like that. And I like to, remind teachers that we never know sort of what type of seeds we're planting in our connections with other kids, with folks. You know, we're with youth all day, every day, 8 hours a day. And that sometimes what you think could be like a meaningful conversation, you know, is actually like a life-saving conversation. I think that's happened to me five times so far. Where youth have come back to me now, and I admire them too, because they're so mature to be able to be strong enough to actually come and acknowledge or thank me is like so precious, but also that they're mature enough to like handle those emotions and then to be able to verbalize it, because you're holding a lot of weight when you're holding a suicidal plan or a thought. You're in such a fragile state. Then to be able to, you know, after some time or et cetera of healing, you know, to go to somebody and say, hey, you played a role. And now I look at those students that say that I played a role in saving their lives, and I see what they're doing, and that's just incredible, because like I know I'm now like woven into the thread of their lives forever, you know? So if one of them is having a kid, going to give birth to her first child this month, and I'm like, you know, I'm not being egotistical, but I mean like, whoa, I'm connected to this kid, like the beauty, it's not about ego, but the beauty of connection is, I think, what life is all about.
So many of our listeners aren't teachers per se, but they work in the professional industry. They have employees or they have team members they're working with a lot. They have children, perhaps. What are some of the lessons you think those people can practice in their daily lives?
Like leaders who are coming from the outside of the education world.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think so much comes down to empathy, you know, compassion and connection. And I think when you have those skills, I think those are the true leadership skills in any profession or role, like in this world, whether you're a politician, you need to listen to people, understand and act, you know, whether you are a leader in, you know, science, technology, the digital transformation, you need to listen, like care and act. Right. And I think if you're in teaching, if you're in business, again, you need to listen to an issue, care about it, you know, and act upon that. And I think once you're doing that, you're going in the right direction. I think so much about being able to listen to people, though, is gaining their trust and building authentic relationships. And then I think also what that allows, when you have authentic, meaningful relationships with your staff, or in my case, with my students, it not only, for example, allows like me to quote unquote lead them, but for them to lead me, because we're connected so that they can also pull me in new directions and show me, hey, I want to run a half marathon. And I'm like, okay, I'll follow you, you know, and to follow those journeys. So I think that continually, like it not only starts with the relationship, but you have to keep investing into that. And once you do that, I think any project will just grow in beautiful ways.
Yes. If there are people now listening, it will be very difficult not to be touched by your story. And if people really want to act, is there a way they can support your plans?
Oh, yeah, sure. Why not?
Yeah.
I am sometimes too shy of attention, but I finally am about to put a website on the internet.
Okay. All right.
I think five years after I won this prize. Yeah. So in about the next month, it should be maybe by like January, it'll be available. So that's a great way for people to want to reach out to me. I also have a LinkedIn profile that they can find me there. Maggie McDonnell on LinkedIn. They can reach out there. But yeah, for sure. If groups want to support any of our projects, like our running club or a kayak program or even get connected to other teachers doing great things. I'm connected to some of the most fantastic teachers now around the world, teachers in Uganda, Kenya, and in the mountains of Nepal, you know, to fantastic American teachers, to teachers in Palestine and more. So yeah, I love making connections. So
we'll share the links in the notes to this podcast.
Yes.
Maggie, thank you so much for your wonderful stories here today.
Yes.
It's incredible. And we're very thankful that you would take the time out of your day in the Netherlands to sit with us.
We were really quiet. In other conversations, Remy and I are much more dominant. But
we were very in awe. Very much in awe. And if you're listening, I hope you enjoyed this episode. And if there's anything going on, we talked a lot about suicide, of course. There is the 113 hotline in the Netherlands, 113. Please look it up if you're struggling with any of those issues. Thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe to our podcast at your favorite podcast platform, and we'll see you soon at another episode of Denk Denk.